Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Whole Scoop Radio with your host, Carol Ferraci, your health and wellness resource, where you get the whole scoop and nothing but the scoop.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. We are The Whole Scoop Radio. We are health and wellness, and where our guests are always highly credentialed in their fields. The goal of this program is to present different, sometimes opposite, perspectives to allow you, the listener, to make informed decisions about what is the right health approach for you. I am your host, Carol Ferraci, a registered licensed dietitian practicing for over 30 years. Sometimes I really hate to admit that, but it's true. I'm also the founder of Naturally Nutrition. You can check me out at www.naturallynutritioninc.com. Yes, you know, it's important for me to provide you highly qualified guests on the topics that we talk about. Wait till you see who we have tonight. Amazing. Just amazing. We're talking about the opioid epidemic tonight, and believe me, you're going to want to listen to all of the show tonight. So before I get into that, of course, I'm going to tell you that while our guests are highly credentialed on the topics of discussion, it's recommended that you seek medical advice prior to implementing any and all interventions discussed on this program. The call-in number is 347-855-8894. You can also direct your questions and comments to Facebook, our Facebook Blog Talk Radio group. Now, we're also doing something new tonight, just brand new. We're in the actual early phases of this, but we have a live chat going, and that you can find via thewholescoopradio.com, and when you sign in, log in via your Facebook page, and boom, you're in, and if you want to interact with us live, you can. So you can access upcoming shows from there. You can access the guest information, listen to previous shows. Of course, we have the live chat, and you can sign up for email notifications. And we're going to start doing some things with series, and we're going to do some seminars and different things with our guests. And so you know, I want you guys to kind of get to know that page a little bit, because you're going to find some information. You'll be able to sign up there. You'll be able to do all kinds of things. So that's thewholescoopradio.com, and I'll say that all again later. 347-855-8894 is the call-in number. If you want to ask questions, remember to press the number 1 to get in the queue for questions. Okay, we're done with that, all that stuff. This is who we have tonight. We have Dr. Raj Hulan. He is a medical doctor and an attorney, but let me tell you about him. He's a physician and a surgeon specializing in trauma and orthopedics. His medical expertise includes diagnosis and treatment of infectious diseases, neurological trauma, and associated disorders, neurodegenerative diseases like multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, and Alzheimer's disease. And he also psychiatric disorders, personality and mood disorders. His medical expertise also includes diagnostic laboratory work, particularly in hematology. His lectures are attended by all healthcare practitioners, and his style of lecturing manages to maintain his audience's attention all day long. I know this. I know it firsthand because I've attended his lectures. This is how I met this guy, this man. He's a fabulous man. I can't wait to just say hello to him and have you get to know him. He will have you, so please, you're going to want to listen to this whole show. So all that being said, let's bring him on. Dr. Holland?
Hi, Carol. How are you? Yes, how are
how
you?
How are you?
Good to be here.
Good. It's so good
well.
To have you. You know what? If it's okay with you, I think I'm just going to let everybody know where you are right now, so in case some noises come by.
Yes,
okay?
Please do that.
You are
I'm
so gracious.
I'm at Midway Airport.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Well, I just wanted your listeners to know I'm at Midway Airport here. That explains all the noise.
Yeah. Well, you know, your noise isn't that bad, but you are sitting in the airport. So, you know, thank you so much for that. And I'm going to tell everybody that, you know, we've all been in the airport. So if something should come up and we have to improvise tonight, we'll do it. Okay. So let's just go with that, okay? So
all
we're
right,
talking about
great.
Opioids tonight, I'm going to just throw out some statistics like I normally do and kind of let everybody get a feel for what we're going to be talking about.
Absolutely.
You know, I was absolutely just – I just got angry looking at these statistics. So I'm just going to read this to you guys from the CDC. It says – we now know that overdoses from prescription opioids are the driving factor in the 15-year increase in opioid overdose deaths. Since 1999, the amount of prescription opioids sold in the U.S. nearly quadrupled, yet there has not been an overall change in the amount of pain that Americans report. Deaths from prescription opioids like oxycodone, hydrocodone, and methadone have more than quadrupled since 1999. What does all that mean? Put that together to, they've calculated it out, and you put that together, there's 55 billion with a B, as in boy, $55 billion in health and social costs related to prescription opioid abuse each year. $20 billion in emergency department and inpatient care for opioid poisonings. And an average day, this is an average day in the U.S., more than 650,000 opioid prescriptions are dispensed. 3,900 people initiate non-medical use of prescription opioids, and 580 people initiate heroin use, and 78 people die from an opioid-related overdose on a daily basis. Now do you see why I got angry?
And you are absolutely right.
See out here, like, this is crazy.
It's absolutely crazy, Carol. I mean, looking at the statistics, you can see that there's obviously a problem with the number of prescriptions being written. And I especially like the fact that you brought up that despite the large number of prescriptions that were written, we still have a problem with pain management.
Right, right. I mean, are we even, is it just something that we do? We just say, hey, it's pain, so, oh, get out the oxycodone? Or, you know, I mean, is that what we're programmed to do now? Is that all we can get to in our brains or what?
No, there's a larger cultural problem involved here. And over the last couple of decades, what's happened is that physicians have gotten into a culture of prescribing medications that they don't really follow up on. Someone gets put on a prescription for, let's say, Lortab, and that person is going to take Lortab, and all he needs to do to re-up the prescription will be to call into the clinic. Now, you get one re-up or something like that, then you got to come up and get reviewed again. But many physicians are pretty lax about that. I was reading today that we've written enough prescriptions to put a bottle of OxyContin in every man, woman, and child's hand in the continental United States today.
You know,
that's,
I read that
right.
Same statistic. That's amazing.
Yeah, that is amazing. Now, what we got to ask the question is, how did we get here? Okay, how did we get here? Now, the state of Kentucky is right now engaged in a legal battle against a pharmaceutical company. This company was primarily involved in the design and trial of OxyContin, which has now, as you know, has become one of the more popular drugs that's being prescribed out there. Now, why is Kentucky aiming at this particular drug company, and what have they done that's so egregious that, you know, the state of Kentucky is incensed? Well, it's very interesting when you look at the history of OxyContin. Right? So back in 1995, the FDA approved OxyContin, so it hit the market the next year in 1996, right? Now, in its first year alone, OxyContin made $45 million for its manufacturer, for that drug company. Now, you know, I mean, if we were talking about the big drug companies like Bayer or Pfizer or any of these, that would not be surprising. But what we're talking about here is a family-owned, a very small pharmaceutical company. And the whole story behind how the drug got approved is, again, very shady from the get-go. So you've got a drug that was actually approved by the FDA, and it was taunted to be completely free of side effects, no threat of dependence. And that's what users were told, right? So the FDA summarily approved the drug, and it went out to market. But here's where it gets even more interesting, Carol. So we have this pharmaceutical company doing its due diligence, trying to identify physicians throughout the continental United States who are most likely to prescribe pain medication.
Okay.
So now they collect a database of these physicians who are most likely to prescribe pain medications, and then they send out their sales force targeting those physicians. And on that end, they double their sales force. So you see where this is going.
Yep. Well,
yeah. So go ahead.
No, you first. Go ahead. I'm just thinking. Go ahead.
I know. I mean, this is really all staggering because, you know, the layperson doesn't get access to this sort of information. It's egregious on so many levels, right? It's profiling, basically, is what it is. It's physician profiling. What did that end up doing for the pharma company that's behind OxyContin? By the year 2000, so we're talking about a mere 4 years after it hit the market, this drug was making $1.1 billion.
Wow.
10 years later, the profits went up to $3.1 billion. So now, here's the question, right? There's a runaway success here with this drug. Doctors are prescribing more and more pain medications. What's the price that society is paying for it? So, sadly, as profits quadrupled, as the number of prescriptions quadrupled, especially with OxyContin, so did the number of overdose deaths. Now, I don't know if your listeners are keeping up with this or not, but about 2 weeks ago in the state of Kentucky, we had 52 overdose deaths in a period of 36 hours.
52? 52, which is terrible. Wow.
And Kentucky is not the only state that's dealing with this issue. I mean, states all over the country are grappling. And if you remember, President Trump himself brought up the issue when he was talking about curbing drug abuse.
Yeah, I do remember that. I do. Yeah. I think that was one of his he hit that quite well on the campaign a little bit. But his statistics were a little off. Yours are much more detrimental. It's amazing.
Now, his statistics were more generalized. I think he was talking about many drugs and not just one or two specific drugs. My concern as a clinician is that I believe that we're a little too lax in prescribing opioids and we don't do a good enough job of following up the patient.
It's not just does the patient have a responsibility in this at all to and I'm not saying blame the patient. Please don't misunderstand that question. It's almost as if, you know, because I know people that have gone on these and they've had chronic back issues or chronic pain issues, and they absolutely hate taking them. That, you know, the people that I know, they don't want to take them, but they don't know how not to take them. And then we're still living. Would you agree that we're still living in a society where not always okay to, you know, a lot of people still think it's not okay to question your physician. And this is one of those topics where you should question your physician.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, Carol. And that's one of the things that I bring up at my seminars all the time. The lay patient goes in and the clinician assesses the patient and then writes a prescription for pain medication. Now, I have gone in with my family members to see physicians. And my mother-in-law, for example, I went with her to see her physician. He prescribed her oxycodone. He did not give her the kind of information that I would have expected a physician to give her. Like, and what would that be? All right, this is a pain medication. It is an opioid. You can take this pain medication for your pain, but understand that opioids can cause dependence. Now, that's the kind of instruction that you give to the lay patient, because they're going to follow what the clinician says to the letter. They're not.
And that's responsible. That is being responsible to your patient, giving them the information that they need to make that kind
of
decision.
Absolutely. And from my understanding, from my experience, patients generally do not want to take medication. The new groundswell of opinion on the part of the patient community is that they're only going to take medication that they absolutely have to take. So you may have a patient who's under a lot of pain, who can't manage with an NSAID or any other medication. And so they have to go to the doctor. They break down to go to the doctor. They get the prescription for the opioid, and they take the opioid. Now, if they had that instruction and if they knew that there was a risk of dependence, I'm pretty certain that we'd have very different statistics today.
I agree. And I think that, you know, that's why I do this show. It's to allow people to have the information that they need to make informed decisions. Because we in healthcare alone, we're just not very good at making sure that people have informed decision-making abilities.
We
really do need to all get better at this, but especially on this particular topic, because let's just take a second and just do a life in a patient that gets addicted to opioids. Now what happens? You know, they had a chronic back issue. Their intention was to feel better. Their intention was not to become so addicted that they couldn't function without it. So now, how does that change their lives? What does that mean? And then how does that look from the continuum of care for the healthcare perspective?
It certainly complicates the life of the patient, that's for sure.
Yeah, but it also, I mean, if you really want to get down and dirty, it complicates the life of the patient. It stagnates the life of the patient because now they're just so dependent upon this particular drug that their lives become different, that they change their way of life to accommodate the drug because they're addicts, and then they have other health issues combined as a result of this. So now they're seeing other physicians for other things and other types of issues, and now maybe they have other drugs that they're taking as a result of that. And so what are they doing physically to themselves? And then let's look at the overall cost of healthcare. So are these practitioners, are these physicians that are prescribing, are they actually doing any service of good to either the patient or the healthcare continuum?
Well, that's a great question, Carol. And if all these clinicians are doing is writing a prescription for an opioid, then the answer to that question is no, they're not. I'll give you an example. I've had patients that have come up to me and they're concerned that they're taking an opioid and they don't want to take the opioid, but they can't get off of it. So the first question I ask them is why they needed an opioid in the first place. And typically they'll tell me they've got some kind of a spinal disorder or a back disorder, like spinal stenosis. Right? Now, my question to them is always, did your physician give you a referral to see an orthopedic specialist? The answer to that is almost always no. Now, the right thing to do would have been refer the patient to an orthopedic specialist. Let's see if we can do something on that spine. We could fuse that spine. We could plate it. We could do something to alleviate the problem. Isn't it better to take the problem out of the equation completely rather than to just mask the pain with an opioid that, you know, your patient would go on taking and ending up with a dependence on? So
absolutely.
Here again, the system fails the patient. The system fails the patient.
Well, you know, we use a lot of buzzwords in healthcare, and you know, now the buzzword that I'm hearing, well, that has been going on for a while, patient-centered care, patient-directive care. You know, what you're describing to me is not that. What you're describing to me is physicians saying, here, do this, without any real information. And please understand, I'm not even saying, look at these physicians, they're horrible. I'm just saying, this is what we do. This is just a practice. We don't give enough information. We allow our patients to continue on a path of their own. And no one's really putting that patient in the center of anybody's care.
No,
they're just kind of
putting
them at the fringe of, because then, you know what happens? I'm going to take your scenario, and I'm going to take it one step further, and you tell me if you agree. Because they'll go, no, they didn't get a referral to an orthopedic person. But maybe after a course of so many medications and now they truly do have an addiction and their pain level is not managed, then maybe they'll go see an orthopod. If they're lucky, they might get a referral to that. But by then, they're already down this other path. And so how much is an orthopedic person going to actually be able to help them before you have to undo what's already been done with medication?
Well, here's the irony, right? So now, if I'm the orthopedic specialist and I get the patient referred to me, patient's been taking an opioid for months now, right? Before
right.
I can do anything for the patient, I got to make sure he's off of the opioid.
Right, you got to clean him up first, right?
Absolutely, right? So that's more time wasted on the part of the patient and more cost incurred and
right.
just something that's bogging down the system.
And who ultimately suffers for this? I mean, you know, we're using one patient as a conduit for all of this, and I don't hear about the patient getting any better through all of this. It just becomes a vicious cycle. And then I've seen this happen with people, and they just get thoroughly disgusted, thoroughly depressed. Now they have a secondary situation going on with depression. They're not able
right.
to work because the pain level is higher. So now they have some kind of disability. They're declared for disability. Now
right.
their whole lives are completely different, and they're completely different people from when they started taking that one medication.
Yes. You know, it's a sad, sad end to a story. I mean, it destroys the patient's life. You know, I'm reminded of another argument. It's an analogy to the situation that we have here. Like in politics, for example, we hear about how politicians want to revise the tax code. Everybody wants to revise the tax code, right? And
right.
nobody actually does anything about it, because while they're talking about revising the tax code, they're at the same time taking money from the very people who prepare taxes to propagate a system that's already in place. Now, how does that analogize to what we're talking about here? All right, everybody wants to do something about the opioid epidemic, but you and I can't even get two matching set of statistics from two different authoritative websites. Have you noticed that? You can go to one website.
I absolutely
website.
Did. I mean, I have to really pick my statistics on this because everybody says something different.
Absolutely. So the statistics are as clear as mud, so to speak, right?
So
we can't agree on the numbers, and we talk a lot about the problem as it is. We make a big stink out of diseases like Zika. Now, how many Zika cases did we have here in the States around Miami? Not even 10, right? Not even
right.
10. And all these cases were asymptomatic. They just tested positive. Well, here we're losing tens of thousands of people every year to an actual epidemic. And how much TV time do we get on this? And who's talking about this? Barely anyone.
Nobody. Nobody's talking about this. You know,
yeah.
they might bring it up a little bit. They might say, yeah, we have an opioid problem, but they don't really tell people what we're talking about. I mean, these numbers are staggering. And the cost associated is just amazing. I mean, we haven't even talked about the ethics of this. So, I mean, I don't know that you can put a dollar value to the ethics, but you probably could based on the fact that I'm willing to bet that this shortens lifespan, and I'm sure somebody out there is calculating those statistics. And if that's the case, then we've got a whole different set of ethics going on there. Huh?
Oh, we do. We do. The most frightening statistic for me comes from the National Institutes of Drug Abuse. NIDA calculates that in 2011 alone, the number of prescriptions written had tripled to 219 million. Right? That's 219 million, and that's 6 years ago, give or take.
Wow.
So I don't expect that number has come down. If anything, it's either right there or probably gone up. Now, what is the federal government doing about it? I'm heartened to know that they've taken some steps. Now, we know that naloxone is used to treat or reverse opioid overdoses. So, naloxone, for those of our listeners who are not very familiar with it, is also known as Narcan. And Narcan basically works as an opioid antagonist. Right? So an antagonist drug is basically a drug that occupies the same receptor within the nervous system that an opioid molecule would occupy. It's kind of like if there's two of us trying to get a seat, and if I am Naloxone, if I'm Narcan and I take that seat, then Mr. Opioid can't sit there. And if Mr. Opioid can't sit on that seat, then Mr. Opioid can't create the problems that opioids create. So that's basically the principle of an antagonist. So there's a thrust on Naloxone. We're also using, in terms of treatment, we're trying to use buprenorphine. We're also using, as you know, methadone. And these are all options right now. But Naloxone is actually right out at the front, because this is what your EMTs have with them. This is what they use when they come upon someone that is in the very deep stages of being overdosed, right? Who's at risk of losing their lives. So I'm glad that we're focusing on that. There are, as you know, there are three FDA-approved formulations. There's an injectable, there's an auto-injectable, and then there's also a nasal spray. So it's heartening that we're actually looking at stuff like that and trying to make it more accessible.
So let me just recap that just for a second for everybody, that because there was some noise there. So there's an opioid antagonist, and
right.
That's a popular drug, and most common name is Narcan. And so when somebody is in the deep throes of an addiction, that's what they're getting, so that the receptor sites in the body and the nervous system and the central nervous system are blocked by the opioid receptors are blocked by the Narcan. Is that what you said?
That is absolutely what I was saying. So Naloxone is actually a rescue drug, is what it is, basically.
Okay.
So what EMTs are trying to do, what quick responders or rapid responders are trying to do, is they're trying to administer Narcan or Naloxone as quickly as possible to reverse the effects of opioids. Now, the more Naloxone binds to opioid receptors, the better the chance that the patient will survive. So the Department of Health and Human Services is making a concerted push, and all of this information is readily available. Right, so their mission statement and their mission of the agency itself is to expand access to Naloxone through grants, federal grants, and this Naloxone is then going to high-need rural and tribal communities. Now, why are we even looking at tribal communities? Now, here's another shocking statistic for you. Right now, the two demographics that just strike out at you when you look at it, most overdose deaths involve Caucasian and Native American.
Oh, wow. Right?
Now, yeah, this is not what you would typically expect to see. Now, of course, many people will ask, but when you have so much gang-related activity among all the different segments of population, why is it that it's the Caucasians and just the Native Americans that are in this situation? Well, interestingly enough, because of, and I hate to use the word, but, you know, there is an element of racism involved here. Clinicians tend not to prescribe as many opioids to people of minority color, you know, whether you are Asian or African-American. They don't do that. So as a result, what happens is it's kind of like a backlash from that. So you profile against one community, but actually you're helping them, because now they don't become a target statistic.
You know, I never knew that. I never came across that. Thank you for that. That's amazing.
It's a shocking shocking statistic.
Yeah.
So what the Department of Health and Human Services is trying to do is trying to provide Naloxone or access to Naloxone so that these communities can avail of it. For example, at the end of 2015, 1.8 million in grant funding was actually awarded to increase the availability of Naloxone. So this is something that is continuing, and I'm confident, I'm actually happy that they're doing this, because, you know, you've got to save the patient first. I mean, all the debate can take place afterwards. You've got to save the patient first, and first responders absolutely need Narcan. They absolutely need Naloxone.
So then does it... does it work? I mean, it works to save them for that moment, right? But on the long term,
absolutely,
talking some serious rehab, right?
Well, and you know, and that's where the societal cost comes in, because now a lot depends on the victim, right? They've got to try to get themselves into a program. They've got to get themselves cleaned up. But the problem comes in that, you know, after they get cleaned up and they're all ready to start off again, they go back to the very same communities, to the very same families and circle of friends that propagated the addiction in the first place. So we've got to do more. We've got to do more than just clean up people and send them back to where they're just going to fall back into the same trap again.
And you forgot one other thing that they go back to, and I'm just willing to bet on this. I don't have any statistics on this one, but I'm willing to bet they go back to the same doctor.
And they go back to the same doctor. You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. Now, I want your listeners to understand that, you know, we have a very saintly projection or image of clinicians because, you know, clinicians in white coats save lives. But I want you to know that there's a fair amount of physicians that are serving time in federal prisons, okay? And why are these folks in federal prisons? Well, there are many clinicians who get tempted into writing prescriptions for opioids for money. It's a quick way to make money.
Let's talk about that one for a minute.
Okay.
So we'll break that down a little bit. Okay, so I'm going to reiterate just a little bit because we had a little more noise there. So there are a fair amount of physicians that are serving time in federal prison right now because of excess prescriptions of opioids. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So that being the case, then, how does one get caught that way? Is it because billing too much to Medicare? Are they billing too much to the insurance companies and somebody red flags for or is it the refill on the prescriptions? Is it, you know, how does that person get caught versus somebody else? And is it possible someone else to fly just under that radar knowing, because they're in jail because they wrote prescriptions or excess prescriptions to make money, right? Specifically.
Absolutely. Now, the only way you're going to be able to catch a physician doing something like that is to catch him red-handed, to catch him or her red-handed. So if you remember, about 2 or 3 years ago, there was a special on the opioid situation in Broward County in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the Fed did was they staked out a clinic. There was a tip-off. And so they staked out a clinic. And they watched as, in this one episode, a car pulls up, and there are three individuals in the car. One person gets out, goes into the clinic. Right? Now, I don't know what transpires in the clinic, but that person comes back out, and he has a prescription. Now, he takes the prescription to the pharmacy down the block. Now, this is all in the same block, right? He walks over with the prescription, goes into the pharmacy, and he's able to fill that prescription. He brings the oxy back out, gets into the car where the other two people are waiting, and then they take the tablets out, they crush them, they put them on foil, they heat them with a lighter, and inhale the vapors.
Wow.
And this is happening right outside the clinic.
They just didn't even care. They just came right out from the clinic and did it.
Absolutely. I mean, that's how brazen this situation is. And you know, the kind of people who do this sort of thing, clinicians, they get lulled into a sense of complacency, and so they take these risks thinking that nothing can happen to them. And they do it. They do it. And so, you know, you've got this kind of a situation. I mean, if it's happening in Broward County, I mean, could
it's
it be happening
everywhere?
Yeah. Absolutely. It could be
I mean, it's just, you know, when I see the statistics for how many people are addicted, I see the statistics on how much money is spent on the addictions alone, then you couple it with the number of physicians that are actually in federal prison for doing this, for just making money. How is this a no-win situation? Is this something that, I mean, how You remember we used to say things like the war on drugs? Is that even, like, feasible?
Well, to answer that question, again, we've got to lean more towards what's happening politically in this country. So we have laws. There are laws on the books to prevent abuse of dollars in healthcare, to abuse Medicare, Medicaid dollars. But these laws are only effective if you give teeth to them. In other words, if you enforce them. Now, last year, towards the middle of last year, there was a physician who was arrested for Medicare fraud. Now, you know, this is going to happen. This guy was billing Medicare for services that were never provided. He was billing Medicare for patients that he never saw. And the sad thing about this is that the figure involved was upwards of $200, $250 million. That's just one person. And the even more sadder aspect of this whole debacle was that this guy had been convicted before and had spent time in prison, had come out and went back to the same racket. How was one watching this?
Oh, wow. And how long was he able to operate until he was caught again?
About 4 or 5 years.
Seriously, wow. Really? That's what I have to say about that.
And, you know, when I talk to physicians and when I talk to patients, individuals who are interested in the healthcare services this country has to offer, I keep telling them the same thing. There is enough money in the system to provide every man, woman, and child, every legal man, woman, and child in this country with healthcare for free. We have the money. The problem is so much of that money is being wasted. There's so much fraud because enforcement is just not effective. It's about as effective as enforcement of immigration has been. It's about as effective as enforcement against the recreational drugs or street drugs has been. I mean, this is something that needs to be worked on. Now, I'm heartened that the new administration is talking about, you know, actually using these laws. Let's see that happen. And think of all the money we're going to save, and that money can be reinvested into the system to help people. It's a $250, almost $300 billion industry.
And this is a little facetious on my part, so I put that right out there. But you know, we've been talking in this country for a long time now, especially through this last election, and even now, about building a wall and keeping all the criminals out and you know, making sure the border to Mexico is safe because we don't want the drugs coming in. But we're not talking about street drugs. We're talking about prescription medications. We're talking about an epidemic, and we're talking about everyday people's lives being thoroughly disrupted and never the same as a direct result and impact of the pharmaceutical industry along with some physicians. And so
absolutely,
nobody's really looking at that particular perspective. They're just looking at building a wall. Now, I'm not saying that's not important. I'm not saying anything. I'm not giving a political opinion about any of that. I'm just saying look at what we're focusing on, when in fact maybe if we focus in our own backyards and literally in our own living room, we might be able to help somebody.
Absolutely. I mean, it's easy to just look away and vilify somebody for a problem that we actually have created ourselves. It's white collar crime. That's what we need to call it. It's white collar crime. That's all it is. And instead of trying to nip it at the bud, here's what we're trying to do. Now, the Obama administration's proposal was to increase funding for up to about $1.1 billion to make sure that everyone who has an opioid use disorder can get the treatment that they need. Now, if we took that $1.1 billion, or even half that amount, and used it for enforcement, don't you think that would be a better use of money?
You broke up there. You use it for what?
For enforcement, to make sure that the problem doesn't arise.
For enforcement, right. Yeah, absolutely.
Enforce the laws on the books.
Yeah, I mean, if we already have laws on the books and we're not looking at this, you know, you can talk about repealing and replacing all the health care in the world, but if you would just take this one component, if you know, let's focus on what really is happening here. Taking this one component alone with these particular numbers would change our entire health care delivery system. Because they could take that money, roll it back, and actually start doing some preventative stuff.
Absolutely.
This is amazing to me. This is just phenomenal that these numbers are so out of control.
Yeah, and it's sad, isn't it, how we don't ever talk about that.
No, we don't. We really don't. So I'm here. I'm saying right now, you know, this show gets archived into people access this show all the time when we're not on the air. So I'm hoping that more people will pick this up. We're going to circulate this program even more. This is probably one of the most important shows that we've done, and that's because this is so unknown, and it's so important. It's so critically important. So I'm asking everybody, share this with everybody and anybody, because there's not one person that I know that isn't associated or impacted by somebody on one of these medications.
Absolutely.
It's just rampant. It really is. I mean, you could be in a room full of people, and if you're in a room full of 50 people, you can best believe that at least a quarter of them, if not more, probably more like half, have either attempted to try or have tried or continue to be on one of these opioids by their doctor.
Absolutely.
And so that alone is staggering. So I want to ask everybody, if you're going to ask a question, press the number one. If you're like me, at this point, the information is just swimming in your heads and you're probably not even sure what to ask. But if you have something going on personally that you want to just say, you know, what's happening, that would be good. We have a couple blog questions. You want me to let me do that right now, okay?
Sure. Let's do that.
Okay. Let's see. We've got, I was in an accident while pregnant. I didn't know I was pregnant at the time. The hospital gave me oxycodone. I took it for about 2 weeks, then learned I was pregnant. I am in my fifth month. Everything looks good. My doctor isn't too worried about it, but I can't get it out of my head. Should I worry about my baby?
That's a great question. And here's how you approach it. Now, ideally, you don't want to take any medications in the first trimester of pregnancy, right? Nobody wants to do that. Your circumstances were unique in that you didn't know you were pregnant, and you took the opioid. Now, once you found out you were pregnant, you stopped taking the opioid. What you need to do at this point onwards is to follow up with your OB, make sure the baby is developing normally. Now, any abnormalities are easy to pick up, would be able to be detected at this point. It doesn't mean that if you take an opioid, it's automatically going to affect your pregnancy. The key word here is that it can affect the pregnancy, right? So hope for the best, keep your follow-ups regular, talk to your OB, and go with that.
Okay, great. Thank you. That is Sue in Cincinnati. So, Sue, good luck, and I think just follow up is the best choice here. Thank you so much, Doc, for that.
Absolutely.
Now, let me just do some. I've got to do some business here. I'm just gonna have to like go back, tell everybody what they're listening to. So give me a minute, okay?
Okay. All right.
All right. So.
You're listening to the Whole Scoop Radio with your host Carol Ferraci, your health and wellness resource, where you get the whole scoop and nothing but the scoop.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Dr. Raj and we're talking about the opioid epidemic. And if you've been paying attention, you can tell by the tone of my voice that I'm getting a little excited about this because it's kind of out there and out of control. But I want to say thank you to Dr. Hoole for being here and let you know that you can reach him at rhoolon, H-U-L-L-O-N, at gmail.com if you have a question or two about that. Also want to let you know that we are live tonight, and we're doing a live blog tonight on our new site. So that site is thewholescoopradio.com. You can catch us over there. And please sign up for that because you'll be able to get some email notifications from us, find out what's coming up, find out what's going on. And listen to previous shows, find out more about our guests, and start a blog, too. So we're going to, and I think this is a great topic to start a blog. You know me. I'm your host, Cheryl Ferraci. Find me at naturallynutritioninc.com, or now, find me at thewholescoopradio.com. So all that being said, we got a question on the board. You want to take a live question now?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. All right, we're going to go with caller 2205.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm actually in the healthcare field, and I'm in and out of charts all day, and I noticed that there's so many people that are on opioids, and I'm just wondering, is there, like, any other options for these people to be prescribed? Because you still want to manage their pain if they're in a lot of pain. But are there, like, other ways to get away from this? Because it just seems like this is an epidemic that is just a revolving door. They're going to keep needing things to tolerate this pain. And I was just wondering if you had an answer for that.
Absolutely. That's a great question. You're right, it is a revolving door, and it's more a cultural problem than anything else. Our culture of frontline medical practice involves the physician giving in to the patient. You know, the patient comes in, they've got something in mind that they want, and most physicians will acquiesce and write the prescription to make the patient happy. We've got to stop doing that. You have to assess the patient for levels of pain. You've got to understand why the patient is in pain. From my perspective, the first thing you got to do is find out if there's a permanent solution. Is there a surgery that can be performed on the patient to help them with that problem? Now, if you run out of options and you have to give them something for pain, an opioid should not be your first choice. You can rely on NSAIDs like ibuprofen. If you can't do the NSAIDs, then there are the opioid receptor agonist drugs like tramadol, which I'm sure you heard of. So there are options other than opioids, and what we need to do is a better job of educating our frontline medical care practitioners that they have to go to those options before resorting to an opioid. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. I just feel like there's just such a lack of education for the consumer out there that they don't know that this is something
consumer,
that's bad.
Right, and the consumer or the patient doesn't know, but it's the job of the clinician to suggest the treatment. The other thing that gets in the way is the assembly line mentality that we have in clinics where all the clinician wants to do is get through with the patient so they can see the next one and the next one and the next one.
Which is also an epidemic that's leading to all of this.
I'm sorry?
I said that's another epidemic, but that's a whole other issue.
Oh, yeah, that's a whole other issue. Absolutely. Well, thank you for your question.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. We've got, let's see, I think we got another question on the board. So give me a thank you for calling. Did we answer your questions?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Okay, we've got another one, and this is caller 6865.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, sir. I've been going to a pain management place for, I guess, about 7 or 8 years. And for the first time in 5 years, I actually got to see my doctor today. 5 years.
Oh.
Can you imagine waiting to see your doctor and seeing all these PAs? No one seems to know how to listen. What do you do when you're at a place and they obviously are not listening? I've left prescriptions there because I had reactions to them.
Oh.
What do you do to hold them accountable? Like that caller that just called in, she sounds like someone that could work at my pain management place. It's the lack of listening.
Well, that's a great question. And when Carol and I were talking about a cultural problem in medical practice, that's exactly what we were talking about. Now, you've been going for, what did you say, 8 years to this pain management clinic?
Yes, same one.
And you
and
just
I told
got to see your doctor for the first time.
I have lupus, and I have I've had some different changes in my body. But
right.
I've been telling them that I took some arthritis medicine by Tylenol, and it seemed
right.
to help. Could we try
right.
something else that was more anti-inflammatory? And they did an
right.
MRI because they wanted to put an injection in the lower half of my spine, though I have pain
okay.
in the upper half. Last time I checked, those shots don't go upwards. And lo and behold, I have heavy arthritis in my neck. They did not listen
okay.
to me.
Well, the injection that you're talking about seems to me like an epidural injection, and it's usually a cocktail of a steroid and a local anesthetic.
Right.
Now, to correct you, you can inject it in the lower spine, and it can affect nerves that are above it to an extent.
Really?
Now, it's not going to affect stuff that's going on in your neck, obviously. That's a whole different ball game, right? Now, with
right.
the arthritis in your neck, you've got to figure out what the problem is. Do you have any images, any films?
I have an MRI disc. They wanted me to
okay.
go see a surgeon, but the doctor I saw today said it wouldn't help. So I'm like,
right.
well,
can
what
I
am I supposed to do?
Can I ask how old you are?
I am 47. I had to think.
Okay. Well, you're very young. You're way too young to be considered, in my opinion, for fixation in the neck or fusion. So if they have an intervention, like if they're willing to inject or maybe even physical therapy for your neck, I would go with that first. All right? Now, fusion of your cervical vertebrae in your neck should be your last option. It's obviously what's going to happen with that. Yeah, because that's going to affect mobility and you know, it's not going to take away all your mobility, but it will reduce it significantly. So you want to maybe hold off on that.
Now, I heard that marijuana helps with anti-inflammation. I know nothing of it. Is there anything to the fact that marijuana in certain forms can help with inflammation?
No.
Okay.
What marijuana will do is it will suppress your sensation of pain.
Well, that doesn't help.
That is, yeah, that it's a whole different ballgame.
Well, that's good to know because, I mean, my friends say one thing, but they're not doctors and they're not educated in that area.
No,
so.
Absolutely. Always get your advice from a reliable source.
Right. I'll continue not to.
Why we do this show.
Marijuana.
Thank you very much for your question.
Thank you, sir. It was helpful. It was helpful.
Thank you so much for calling in.
If I can continue to listen, thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Okay, and we've got another blog question. Boy, this is just really great tonight. Okay. My 42-year-old husband, this is actually out of Pennsylvania. My 42-year-old husband has chronic back issues and has been on oxycodone for 3 years. Says it doesn't help much anymore, but he can't stop taking them. He says the pain is about the same, but he feels horrible and can't function. Now has a cardiac condition and needed a pacemaker. I think this is related. Am I wrong? What should he do?
Well, again, that's an excellent question. And I think that situation pretty much sums up where everybody who has a problem with opioids is at right now. The thing of it is that we've got to find a solution for the back problem. Now, I don't have details on what the back problem is. But I certainly think that referral to a spine specialist would be a good idea. Once we have an idea of what the problem is in the spine, then we can start thinking of permanent solutions. Now, obviously, we're going to have to get way down on the oxycodone before we go into surgery. But think about how nice it would be if we can fix the problem in the spine permanently and you don't have to rely on pain medication. And that should be the goal of everyone who's taking an opioid for a musculoskeletal problem that we can resolve through surgery.
Don't you think that should be the goal in healthcare in general, that we should look at the core root of the problem and try to fix that before we mask it with medication and or surgery? Or, I'm not saying that those are bad choices. I'm just saying that maybe they shouldn't be the first choice.
You're absolutely right. And I tell you, a high schooler could tell you the same thing. It's so obvious, and yet, we just befuddle it by making things more complicated than they are, And here again, this is the duty of the frontline general care practitioner: make sure that their patients get the right assessment so they can have the right treatment, conclusive treatment.
Yeah, but again, somebody needs to follow up on that. Somebody needs to watch the patient so that they can make sure that they're doing the right thing. So how does that work in our healthcare system as it is? Because, I think we can all pretty much admit that things are not just in the pain management side, but things are falling through the cracks, and mainly, when I say things, I mean people, falling through the cracks
right, by
virtue of who's watching the patient.
Right. Well, here again, I think the industry has to do a good job of policing itself and enforcing, like the Controlled Substances Act and things of that nature. Clinicians have to go for training. They have to have continuing education on what opioids do and how they cause dependence. Because believe it or not, these are physicians, general practitioners. They do a lot of different things. And they can't really be expert at one thing. So we have to educate them. And then at the same time, we have to enforce regulations, laws, and make sure that prescriptions are written the right way for the right patient. There has to be documentation to show that the patient was offered conclusive treatment. And if the patient refuses, then that has to be an issue that needs to be brought up. The patient cannot be right when it comes to this sort of thing. The clinician has the power in deciding what is right for the patient. The patient cannot demand a medication, but the physician needs to understand that. There's a lot we could do, Carol. This is something we could talk about all day long.
I think I'm feeling a seminar from you coming out on this particular topic. That's what I think.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to do it.
I think that I know a bunch of clinicians that will be signing up for that seminar, like, immediately. So,
absolutely.
That, okay? We are just about out of time. I told you the hour was going to go by quickly.
You were right.
We are seriously out of time. I want to thank everybody for listening, for blogging, for calling in, and now hopefully participating in our live chat the next time around, knowing that we've got this. Remember, that's thewholescoopradio.com. And then you can also catch us on Facebook. Let us know what you want to hear. Let us know what you want to do. What you want us to cover, because we're willing to do it, and we'll go from there. And as you well know, we don't always just do one area. We do all kinds of things. We do traditional. We do alternative. So our next show is on March 9th at 7 p.m. Eastern, and we are going to have the internationally acclaimed intuitive coach, Kumari. He has traveled the world doing intuitive healing. So we're going to find out about all that, and we're going to learn more about that. Tune in for that. Dr. Holland, I can't thank you enough. I can't tell you how honored I am that you've done the show, and that the amount of information you've given us tonight is just staggering, and I'm just so grateful. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol, for having me on. And I do apologize for the noise around me. Circumstances just led me here and beyond my control. But thank you very much for having me on your show today.
Well, we're hoping to have you back, if that's okay.
I would be honored.
Well, thank you so much. And you know what? I think maybe next time we should do a show on the ethics of this kind of thing. And
sounds like a good idea. Absolutely.
Yeah, let's try that. Okay, everybody, I'm going to say goodnight. I'm going to tell you we're going to see you on the 9th and say thank you very, very much for tuning in and for participating. And we always enjoy that. Thank you. So, goodnight, everybody.
You.